B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, a man who knows the door code to every on-course restroom in the Southeast, Charlie Nance.
Welcome back once again. We're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. At the start of the PGA Tour season, I looked at the upcoming condensed calendar, and there were two things I was absolutely sure of. A, 3 weeks after the Masters and 2 weeks prior to the PGA, there was no way the Wells Fargo Championship was going to have anything short of one of the best fields of any regular stop on tour. And B, with the Big Bucks Wyndham bonus, this week's stop in Greensboro was going to get some big names too. On both counts, I wasn't just wrong, I was loud wrong. We'll discuss this and more with Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer. Also, last week I had the chance to catch up with David Woosley. Woos, who is three decades caddy on the PGA Tour, currently on the bag for Sam Burns. He's always insightful on so many levels. But we begin today with CBSSports.com's Eye on Golf, Kyle Porter. Well, let's get started with this. A couple of weeks ago, we swapped messages. I was down at Myrtle Beach. My son was playing in a golf tournament, and I looked up at the pro shop, and there was Morning Drive on the Golf Channel. And lo and behold, there was Kyle Porter. When did you start doing some TV work with the Golf Channel? How did I miss this?
I think all their people were on vacation, and they were just finding randoms on Twitter to come out there and do it. I mean, I think that's how it went down, honestly.
Did you have a good time doing it? I thought you did a great job.
Yeah, I appreciate that. No, it's fun. It's more fun than I thought it would be, I think. I think there's so much apprehension going into something like that, just that you haven't done before. And you're like, well, I think I know the subject matter. I think that I can just, be coherent in the way that I talk about this. But there's always that kind of low-grade thing in the back of your mind of like, this is live television, so don't say something stupid or curse or, whatever. But no, it's fun. Everybody down there is super nice. They have a ton of people working on that show, making it really good. It's been a cool experience to get to do that.
Yeah, no, my fear is, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Broadcast News. It doesn't matter how much I know about the subject. I would be sweating like Albert Brooks. It would just be a pool going through everything I own. It would be a disaster. Kyle Porter is CBSSports.com's Eye on Golf. He's our guest taking dead aim. Hey, before we get your thoughts on the majors in general, I wanted to ask you about the Open Championship. I read your piece on CBSSports.com, and you were physically and emotionally moved by what you saw. I was too. What was it for you about what we witnessed at Portrush?
Yeah, I think that Shane Lowry is just somebody that is relatable in a way that Brooks Koepka is not, in a way that Jordan Spieth and Justin Thomas and Dustin Johnson and Ricky Fowler are not. And I don't know, man. It was just, some of his quotes are unbelievable. When he was talking, the one specifically, when he was talking about on how on Sunday he was like, I woke up not knowing if I had what it takes to be a major champion. And you're like, wow, like, who says it? Can you imagine Brooks Koepka saying that?
No, Koepka would be like, I'm the only one that has what it takes.
And so, to me, like, the ability to relate to somebody in not just professional sports, but anybody who's that good at their craft, I'm like, oh, yeah, I woke up not knowing if I had what it takes to, like, be a good dad or to, like, be an accountant or to, like, whatever, be a good husband. And so, like, I don't know. There was just something when you meshed that with the whole Ireland, Northern Ireland thing and like how many people were kind of rooting for him. And I don't know. There was something special about the way that kind of unfolded to end the major season this summer.
Kyle, I, speaking of relatability, I know you're a huge Rory fan, as am I. I've said for years, I'll continue to say, when he's firing all cylinders, for example, like last Saturday in Memphis, my eyeballs say he's the best, and there's a margin there. If possible, I gain more respect for Rory in failure, yet embracing who he is, where he came from, and the people who claim him as their own. And I felt for him more on an individual level than I ever have for him as a player. I felt like maybe we were witnessing an epiphany or maybe the beginning of an evolution for him. Am I overstating or romanticizing this?
Well, I think only time will tell. You know, I mean, Rory's so hard because his major struggles have both been overblown but also underplayed somehow. Like, it's almost going both ways. But to your point, like, I think that sometimes you get these guys at that level, and it's not their fault. I think Rory is as thoughtful and as smart and self-aware as a professional athlete gets. But you just get into a bubble. You know, you're in your team bubble, you're in your own life bubble, and you forget, I think, sometimes, like, where you're from. You know, you forget who you grew up with. I do that, and I don't make, you know, $50 million a year playing golf. And so I think the reminder of that, I don't know if that'll help him play better golf. Who knows? I think that he is somebody who has an unbelievable ability to sort of explain to those of us who don't know what it's like to be a professional athlete, what it's like to be a professional athlete, and what perspective is from where he's sitting versus where I'm sitting. And I'm fascinated by that. And so I think as a person, did he grow at Portrush? Sure, absolutely. I definitely believe that. But as a player, who knows? I mean, that I posted I did this after Memphis, I think, third round, his last 2 months basically worth of scores. And there's only one outlier, and that's the 79 round one at Portrush. And that's when it really was meaningful and important. And that's not insignificant. I think that got a little bit lost, rightfully so, but it did get a little bit lost, and that was just the bad time to play your worst round of the year.
Kyle Porter, CBSSports.com's Eye on Golf, our guest taking Dead Aim. Now that we've sprinted through the season and all the majors, what are your thoughts on what we've had in year one of the quote-unquote compressed schedule?
Well, I love that the Open finishes it off. Do you love that?
Yeah, you know what? I like it. We'll get to this in a minute, though. I hadn't made up my mind on the PGA. I'm a big believer in branding and labeling, and I think that the PGA abandoned the only brand that it had. But we'll get into that in a minute. But no, I did like the way it ended. It, you know, look, with how beautiful Portrush was and the story, it was almost like a Pressfield novel. It was magnificent.
Yeah, and I think it'll take a couple of years to kind of shift the way that we view this. So coming into this season, we're still on the old viewpoint of like, okay, like just the, for lack of a better term, the body clock of like, hey, this is when the important golf is. Well, we really need to shift that like a month or 2 months backward to like, hey, the important golf starts in like January or February, not March or April, you know? And so I think it'll take a couple of years for fans, for media, for players, for everybody to get used to that. But I'm a fan. We don't need to be playing like high level golf for 10 months a year. Like, it's absurd. And like, I saw Justin Rose complaining. I saw Tommy Fleetwood, Francesco Molinari. Like, it's not like you didn't know when the majors were going to be, you know? And if we kind of equate the majors to playoffs in the NFL or playoffs in the NBA, like, Klay Thompson doesn't have time to fix his shot in the middle of the playoffs. You got to figure it out. And so, like, does that mean we need to have the majors, you know, all in 1 month? No. But just, I don't know, complaining about knocking a month off the major season just seems kind of silly to me.
Okay, let's go through the majors a little bit. As moved as we both were by what happened in Northern Ireland, nothing. I mean, nothing trumps what happened in April at Augusta, not just in golf, but maybe in all of sports this year, right?
Yeah, I think there's a difference between, like, what my favorite thing was and what the best thing was, if that makes
sense. No, I agree with that.
And so, like, I mean, obviously, like, it's almost like it's still almost hard to wrap your mind around. To where you're like I'll have these moments just randomly going throughout a Thursday or a Sunday or whatever, and I'm like, Tiger won the Masters. Like, that's crazy. And so it's almost as if the moment is too big to fully appreciate, like, that it happened in this year. So, yeah, I think if you're talking about most important, best, whatever, it's not really a contest.
Having lived and worked in Augusta for 5.5 years, the image and the sound that I cannot get out of my mind whenever I think about this is I've spent so many hours at that course. I have never, ever heard spontaneous chanting of a player's name like it was a football match with Man U. I mean, it was insane, that scene off the 18th green at Augusta National, to the point that I was looking around going, is this fake? I mean, this doesn't happen at Augusta National.
Yeah, and I think that sort of all coalesced over. It's almost like everybody sort of figured out what was unfolding over the last three holes, and it was a little weird because it was early in the day, and it didn't like there's such a build up, as you know, to like that Sunday late afternoon deal, and it was kind of overcast, and there wasn't that build up. It felt like it was like kind of off by a beat. But then everybody figured out what was happening over the last three or four holes, and you could literally hear and also sort of feel the tension rise, like on the ground. And then it sort of culminated, obviously, with everybody chanting off of 18. And it was very surreal. It was hard to write about because it was surreal to be a part of.
If Tiger never does another thing, if he's never a factor in another tournament again, the big cat gets to ride off into the sunset as the conquering gunslinger, though, no question, right?
Yeah, he should have just walked off Augusta National.
Right? Should have just signed his card, had his kid in his arms, and walked off.
Like, we'll see you at the Champions Dinner next year.
What a savage move that would have been.
That's the play, though. That would have been sick.
Kyle Porter, CBSSports.com's Iowa Golf. He's our guest at Taking Dead Aim. Look, I'll tell you, I was against the PGA moving. I mentioned this earlier. For better or for worse, they had an identity. They were the year's final major. It was a terrible slogan, but it sticks in your head. Glory's last shot. That being said, I guess I could get used to it being in May. It did give us a big boy top of the leaderboard on Sunday. How did you feel about the PGA's move, and what do you think their brand is going to be going forward? What do you think their goal is?
Yeah, I don't know that it changes much for the PGA. I think the PGA is the PGA. You can play it in January, you can play it in August, you can play it in May. I don't think much changes for them, and I think what gets lost a little bit for the PGA of America anyway, is they also do the Ryder Cup, and people think the PGA Tour runs the PGA Championship.
No,
and it's like, no, that's not what happens. And so for them, I don't really see it as that big of a deal. I think the unintended consequence, though, and this is anecdotal because I haven't run the numbers on it. I don't even know. It would take forever to actually do this, and it wouldn't be worth it at all. But it's almost like the tournaments in between, all like the three spaces between majors, so Masters to PGA, PGA to U.S. Open, U.S. Open to Open. Man, it felt like those tournaments suffered.
Oh, and huge, huge. On paper, look, on paper, we have a great event here in Charlotte, the Wells Fargo Championship,
yeah,
on a
yeah.
premier golf course. And on paper, going into the season, I looked at it. Look, we're 3 weeks out of the Masters, 2 weeks before the PGA. We should have an unbelievable field. And it was a stinker.
That was actually one of the ones I was thinking of, was that one. And you had others that, you know, guys, it's almost like the only one that held up for the most part, I guess, was Memorial.
Yeah, Jax.
But I don't know. Everything else is just like barren. I mean, it was kind of rough. And I think, you know, that's a good thing for guys that are like 140 on the money list, for Korn Ferry guys, for whatever. But it's not a great thing for the PGA Tour's brand necessarily. I know they got the players in March, but it almost. The weird part about the whole thing is that it almost made the majors more important, which is really ironic because that's not necessarily what the PGA Tour's goal was. It's not at all what the PGA Tour's goal was. It was to make the PGA Tour more important, to make the playoffs more important, to make the players and the entire season more important, but it almost just served to elevate the four majors and make everything else seem not nearly as important as those four tournaments.
Kyle, I saved, in my opinion, the worst for last, and I am the one voice on this, it appears. Of all the majors this year, I was least happy with the U.S. Open, and I love Pebble. I think it's a national treasure. But when guys are able to go 4-iron, 7 or 8-iron to the 10th at Pebble and pretty much do that on every par 4, Houston, we have a problem. I mean, not only – look, I don't think the U.S. Open can return there. I think technology has outdone it. But speaking earlier of the branding, I also don't understand – what's going on with the USGA and the US Open? This was the sternest test in golf. And with the scores that they were posting, it rendered Tiger's performance in 2000 almost irrelevant to me.
Yeah, I mean, this is a broader conversation, obviously. Pebble was the place. So I hung out there with Andy Johnson and Brendan Porath and Sean Martin the whole week. And Andy obviously runs the Fried Egg. And he's like, this is where he started beating the drum for just change par. Like, why do we, his whole thing is like, why do we need to like change courses or change, I mean, changing technology, yes, of course, but that's
not going to happen,
right? As we both know, that's not going to happen, but just if none of those other things can take place, and if most of them are financially in like not feasible, why not just change par? Why not make Pebble a par 69 or a par 68 or whatever? And I realized that, like, it sounds terrible to say out loud, and you're like, wow, that sounds goofy and kind of dumb. But if that's what people are concerned about or whatever, then I think it makes a lot of sense. Is it the best option? No. Like, would I like to see equipment and the ball and whatever be rolled back so that you bring not only Pebble, but a ton of other courses, really good classic courses, into play, like are in play with the Champions Tour or the LPGA? Yes, that's what I want to see. But if that's not going to happen, then why not just change par and make it at least – I think that changes something in the psyche of these players, and I think it makes it, at least for that tournament, and some others as well at least a little bit more interesting.
I think it's a great idea. Get you out of here on this. Television star and CBSSports.com's Eye on Golf, Kyle Porter, our guest taking Dead Aim. Full disclosure, Kyle is a graduate of Oklahoma State University and is a big college golf fan. So when I ask this question, which is more impressive, what Brooks Koepka has done this summer or what Matthew Wolff and Victor Hovland and Morikawa have done in the last few weeks?
I think the latter.
I think so too.
And I think if it was one guy doing that, like let's say it was just Hovland having the year that he's had, I'd say Koepka. But for all three of those guys, I mean, if you Sean Martin said this on my podcast yesterday, he's like, I think it was Sean. It might have been Chip Patterson. Anyway, I think it was Sean. He said, like, if you're a 38-year-old like touring pro, and you've been on the tour for, like, 11 years, kind of off, you finished, like, 99 in the FedEx Cup or whatever, and you're watching Colin Morikawa and Matt Wolff and Victor Hovland, like, you have to be thinking, like, what am I doing? Like, what is this? And what else is behind them? You know, I mean, I can't remember three guys. I can barely remember one guy.
Yeah, no.
Much less two or three. And so, you know, I think Hovland's going to eventually get his card via the Korn Ferry Finals, but the other two already have their cards for next year. And, you know, Morikawa and Jordan Spieth have the same – are going into the Wyndham, they had the same odds. Jordan Spieth and Colin Morikawa, same odds to win the golf tournament. That's crazy.
He's a great follow on Twitter and a great read on CBSSports.com. That's their Eye on Golf, Kyle Porter. And when we return, veteran tour caddy David Woosley, my man Woos, takes Dead Aim at his man Sam Burns' year, and so much more. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music.
Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos. Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. David Woosley, my man Woos, has been a caddy on the PGA Tour for the better part of three decades. Currently, he's on the bag for Sam Burns, and we had the chance to catch up last week. We were swapping messages at the end of the last week trying to hook up, and you gave me some awful news. What has happened to your guy, Sam Burns?
Yeah, well, you know, he's been playing great the last month or so, even though our weekend up at the John Deere doesn't show that. But and we had a couple of weeks off, and looking forward to competing in Greensboro, which is, you know, that's where I'm from.
It's a home game for you.
Yeah. And then going to Liberty National, and so had every reason to be looking forward to everything, but he called me about 4 or 5 days ago and said he had some bad news that he had broken his ankle.
Oh, nuts.
It was like he was playing some basketball, and I guess there was a little bit of rough housing, and he landed on it wrong, and he's got to wear a some sort of a protective boot, I think, for 4 weeks. So, yeah. Put kind of a damper on things, but
because you were having what I would consider to be, now probably Sam doesn't consider it and you don't consider it, but I consider it to be a fairly strong full rookie season. You'd won more than $1.1 million. You were number 82 on the FedEx Cup list, so you were in a position he was going to keep his card, which when you're a rookie, I think your first go around, if you're able to keep your card, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean that was the priority. And I think, you know, Sam scheduled everything just to try to promote that, to make that happen as soon as possible. And like a number of rookies, and it's not just me, I think you kind of wouldn't agree with sometimes the way they schedule things. I think we played 13 out of 14 tournaments.
Oh.
And so the good news was that you know, at Colonial, a month or so ago, he crossed the supposed number to keep his playing privileges, you know, for the rest of the year. And the not-so-good news, but, I mean, it's actually, anyway, at the Memorial, we had a very poor first round and some kind of, you know, back issues that I believe are, you know, completely legit. And that he played so much, you know, I think his, you know, body just kind of tightened up, and, you know, we were kind of forced to take a couple weeks off. But I look at even that as being not necessarily bad because, you know, we soon thereafter, along with Sam's agent, talked about scheduling and, you know, kind of making a decision to play, you know, 3 weeks in a row. You know, if you have to play 4 weeks in a row and then take 2 weeks off. And so you just kind of learn these things as you go, that you might be 22 and just kind of spitting nails. But, you know, this game, it takes a toll, particularly mentally, and it's going to show up, especially, you know, on Sunday when you're doing really well because you're just overtired.
I'm glad you brought that up. David Woosley is Sam Burns' caddy. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. I'm glad you brought up the mental aspect of it. I had this same conversation with a player on the LPGA Tour, Brittany Altomare, and she talks about how she had to learn in her rookie year and even into her second year, okay, this is how long I can be out on the road before not just I'm physically fried, but I'm mentally fried. And it's as important for me to take care of that as it is the physical. And you've got to get away from it. You've got to get off the road for a week or two, whatever it takes just to recharge your batteries and then go out again.
I mean, that's just flat out true. And it's reflected in pretty much every player you know, that I've spent a lot of time with, particularly when, you know, they're young. And you have to learn, you know, a lot of things, you know, what courses suit you, you know, how to schedule your, you know, put together a schedule from month to month, and how to schedule your practice during the week. So, you know, for instance, you know, Sam now, he'll come into tournaments and we'll play nine holes practice round, just nine holes on a Tuesday. And he does a lot of practice before the nine holes, and then we do a lot after the nine holes and gets some rest later that day. And then we do the same thing on Wednesday. And, you know, the benefit is, you know, more energy and more mental availability. Obviously, we're kind of you have some catching up to do in terms of learning these golf courses. But in some ways, that's where my role comes in. And it's just the nature of it. So, yeah, that's really important.
What is the – is he feeling – what I call the pressure of expectation in this regard? And I was talking with Kip Henley, who's on Austin Cook's Bag, recently about this as well. So many guys are coming out now, and you have the Matthew Wolfs, the Hovlands. These guys are coming out and they're winning instantly. And these are the peer group of Sam Burns. He played junior golf with all of these guys. And Sam is one of these people that when you mention his name to people who are in the know in the game of golf, they go, oh, yeah, that kid's got all the talent in the world. He's got the game to win out here and to be out here for a long time. You can't force winning. Is Sam feeling the pressure of others in his peer group breaking through before he does, or does he recognize this as a process?
You know, I think he's more in the latter there, recognizing this as a process. We haven't discussed any of that, you know, feeling the pressure, so to speak. We have talked, or I have talked a little bit about, you know, I mean, we'll win when we're ready, you know, and it doesn't necessarily mean that we're not ready now, but I feel like we're, you know, just learning, you know, how to compete at that level, and how to regulate, you know, our energy at that level. You know, I don't know that how to define, you know, trying too hard, but, you know, that's not unusual for rookies. And so, like, for instance, there's a fellow, Will Gordon, who's from Davidson, and he's competing this week in Reno at the Barracuda. He was the SEC Player of the Year this past year. He's got a really good game. I haven't talked to him recently, but if I do call him or leave him a text, I would encourage him to try and just play that tournament as if it's a college event. You know, you tend to overthink things, and these players at that level, they're good enough to compete right now, just doing what they're doing. And Sam, back to Sam, you know, he knows that. He has a lot of confidence, and you can see it in every part of his life, really. And the way, just the way he, you know, moves around the golf course, and the way he talks to, you know, competitors or his friends out there, he's very, very comfortable. And it seems like the better he plays, the more comfortable he gets. Meaning, you know, he's not afraid of the limelight, so to speak. We just haven't found our rhythm fully yet. But, you know, I feel like it's going to happen. I'm not going to, you know, say, you know, this year or it's going to happen soon, but because you know, when it happens, you just want it to be legit and you're standing on solid ground and you can carry it forward as a, you know, a higher level of play on a regular basis.
David Woosley Woos is Sam Burns' caddy. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. This is not your first rodeo with a really good young player, whether it was Chip Beck or Aaron Oberhoser, and now Sam Burns. I bring up those names because I want to know, equipment has obviously changed, but have players really changed? Is a young player like Chip Beck similar or different from Sam Burns?
You're talking about Chip Beck in his rookie year?
Yeah, I'm talking about Chip when he was young. I'm talking about Aaron Oberholzer when he was young, and now you're on Sam's Bag and he's young. Are they more alike than they are different, or are they really is today's player very different?
Well, I would say they're significantly different and the fact that, you know, Sam Burns and these guys come in here, you know, with all kinds of history of competing with, you know, the best players, heck, the best players in the world, you know, and the competition is so elevated, and they have, you know, the sports psychologists, they have a certain rhythm to what they do, you know, they pay attention to their, a lot of them pay attention to getting proper sleep, you know, and they're ready to go. And that doesn't mean that if, you know, Chip Beck couldn't compete like that back then. In other words, like if they had all of that available to them when they came through for Chip, it was a Georgia, and for Aaron, it was San Jose State. But, you know, when they had all of that, I think they would have been able to come out here and move up the ladder quicker than they did. So, but having said that, there's a lot of refinement in what's going on, and it's only going to get, you know, more challenging as things go on.
Woos, your man is on the shelf for a minimum of, I guess, 4 to 6 weeks. I mentioned that he's number 82 on the FedEx rank right now, has made $1.1 million. No problem staying in the top 125. What is the plan at this point, or have you really talked about it? Are you looking at, okay, we can hop in when this wraparound season starts, or are you going to be able to get into those tournaments? What is sort of the thinking right now, or has there been a discussion?
Well, I think once Sam is green lighted, he's going to want to play.
Yeah,
and he's going to want to play a lot. And but on top of that, he's getting married this December, and you know there's not a whole lot of golf in December, so you know I'm going to be ready, and he's going to be ready, and you know we'll probably have a certain amount of downtime, but he's doing a much better job now of regulating what he does during a week out there, you know, right now, as opposed to 3 or 4 months ago. So, yeah, he's going to want to get after it for sure.
You know, perhaps getting married will give him a new perspective as far as getting off the road a little bit and not staying out there 5 and 6 weeks. He has a reason to go home.
Well, yeah, but, I mean, Caroline's wonderful partner is she comes out quite often, and she's actually advancing her degree online, getting her master's in, I think, counseling. And so I just think they're going to be a great team. They already are. And but they do love being home. I mean, Sam really likes – he lives in a little small town, Ruston, Louisiana. I haven't been there. I understand it's like a one-stop light town.
It is. I think that's where Louisiana Tech is, and I've driven through it a couple of times. And, yeah, if you blink, you miss it.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, they're definitely going to value being home for sure.
Get you out of here on this. Sam Burns, caddy, David Woosley, my friend Woos, is our guest taking Dead Aim. Recently, we just had what I consider to be a fantastic Open Championship. I don't know if you got to watch Royal Portrush, but I'm always intrigued as far as, especially when the bad weather came up. It looks like if you're a caddy at that tournament, when that happens, you need about 12 to 15 sets of arms. But just the preparation for that tournament and the way the ball bounces, I would think that it's far less exacting as far as yardages and things that you prepare for there than you do on a normal tour stop. How different is your job? And I know you've caddied at several Open Championships. How different is your job at that tournament as opposed to your job, say, at the 3M Open?
Well, I mean, I find it more exacting because
really,
when you're playing these length courses, I have described it in the past. Sometimes it feels like you're caddying on the moon. You know, you can't really see your targets. You know, the center of the fairway could be like a church steeple that's about 2 or 3 miles away, and you can't see the right side or the left side of the fairway. So for me, you know, I always go over early, and then I stay up and just work the course, and I literally feel like I live at the golf course. I just try to put in as many hours as I can, you know, because your sight lines are different, the rollouts are different, the wind is, you know, they can handle, you know, elevated winds over there more than you can here. So, and then, you know, like, for instance, you know, at I think Lytham St. Anne's, we might have played with I can't remember, maybe it was Ian Woosnam, and you know, you might miss a green by literally 20 yards. You might be 20 yards short, and you look at these experienced European players, and they're pulling out a putter just to keep it on the ground, stuff like that. So that's the kind of stuff that you kind of have to learn. And so, yeah, I feel like it's really challenging over there. It's a challenge that I enjoy, but it really wears you out.
I've got to look at one of your yardage books one time, because I'm fascinated by the notion of you flipping to hole number six. See that church in the distance? It's a three wood at the steeple. I mean,
yeah. Yeah, and I recall, you know, my first British was with Chip Beck at Lytham St. Anne's, and he probably hit a really good full, you know, three wood, maybe 240 yards. And there was probably, is it a, what's those gullies called? Is it a burn or something
that? The berm, yeah.
Yeah, so I think there was one of those, like, I want to say like 330 yards down the fairway. So it's a three wood, right? Well, we hit it in that. That was like early on Thursday in the competition, and that was really eye-opening. So it's really an amazing tournament, and I love it, and I'm looking forward to Sandband over there.
You know, in one respect, you would be angry as a player because, you know, you just piped it into a berm at 330. On the other hand, you did it with a club that you normally hit 240. You want someone to say, man, Chip, you got big with that three wood.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a good start.
Always enjoy the thoughts of PGA Tour caddies, especially that one. Sam Burns' man on the bag. That's David Woosley, my man Woos. And up next, where are we now with the PGA Tour schedule and this week's event in Greensboro? Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer takes dead aim at those things and more, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
We're taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer is on the beat this week in Greensboro for the Wyndham Championship. Ron, let's start with this. Unquestionably, the number one player in the world is Brooks Koepka. What he does in the majors is beyond impressive. That being said, I got into a discussion earlier this week about how impressive what he did last week was. And I want you to hear me out on this. In my mind, he's got zero pressure on him. He's already made, what, $5 million just in the majors alone. He's getting the Wyndham bonus check this week, sitting on a beach somewhere. He is in that rare position that you get to where he's playing with house money right now. He can be aggressive. He can do whatever he wants. He's got nothing to lose. I'm far more impressed with what I've seen out of Wolf and Morikawa and Hovland in the last month or so. Those are three guys who have everything to lose. They have 6 to 8 events to try to get their card, or, you know, they're in the minors next year. Am I way off base on this?
Well, I think they would all take the position Brooks Koepka's in rather than the position they're in.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, those guys have obviously done a whole lot and made an immediate impact, you know, with their backs sort of up against the wall in terms of having time and opportunities to get their tour cards. And obviously, Morikawa and Matthew Wolff have already won. So, I mean, that's hugely impressive. And they sort of created a new narrative with what they've been able to do and how quickly they've come out, adapted, look like, you know, no big deal. I've just talked to Morikawa yesterday and his high school coach, and interesting, asked Paul Casey, he said, what is it that's different about these guys from previous sort of generations, even just a few years ago from Justin Thomas and Jordan and all that. And Paul Casey says, I don't know what it is, but it's different for sure. He said it's going to take some time to see, but they just come out ready and they expect they can just move along. But they show no fear. They look totally comfortable. They have big games that fit what you need to do today. And you know, here at Sedgefield's a little bit different. It sort of confines you a little bit with the you know, distance is not paramount here. It's about hitting it in the right spots and being able to putt these greens. But, I mean, that's a whole – I mean, who knew 4 months ago we were going to have what we have in terms of those guys now?
Is that, at the end of the day, going to be a major part of Tiger Woods' legacy, beyond all the wins and all the great shots and the records and the this and the that? The fact that – he changed the culture of athletes wanting to play golf, and some of these guys probably wouldn't have been inspired to do and to become what they've become. He's going to leave the cupboard far more full than the way he found it. Do you think he'll ever be given the proper credit for that?
I think he has been given credit for that. You hear players talk about the way they work out and the sort of fitness part of what they do that maybe hadn't existed, certainly hadn't existed to the level it does now when he came out, and he inspired a generation and forced them to get in the gym and do some things. And now I think we've actually seen it. I think we saw it go so far, particularly with sort of heavy weightlifting. You look at what Rory did, what Tiger did, and some others, that maybe they tapered that back a little bit and found a different way. Now, obviously, everybody finds what works for them. But and it became, you know, when I was a kid growing up, they used to tell you, well, you wouldn't want to lift weights, it hurts your golf swing. Obviously, that's not true. But I think they have found a way to make it now. Not only do you work on your long game, your short game, your putting, you work on your body, too. And that's just part of, if you're going to go out and play at the top level, that's just something you have to do.
The Wyndham Championship. Ron Green Jr. is with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. The Wyndham Championship, where you are right now, on paper, when we started this year, I remember you and I both looked at the schedule and we thought that both this tournament and the Wells Fargo Championship had really good spots on the calendar, especially in Wyndham's case with the big bonus that they have. We were wrong. is there any way to fix this?
I don't think it's going to change dramatically. I think it's just, I mean, you know, they've just released a new schedule. There are actually 49 events next year. There's more. It's not getting less. And then the guys are only going to play so many spots. They're not going to be everywhere. You see a couple guys. You see somebody like Webb who's playing 6 weeks in a row, which would never do, you would think. Paul Casey's doing the same thing. I mean, that's why a lot of guys are skipping this week. They played the Open Championship. They played in Memphis in the WGC. And if they're going to take a break with three playoff events coming up, this is the one. I'm sure they're disappointed in the turnout in terms of top guys here. I don't know that it's terribly surprising given the way the schedule stacked up. Maybe a little better next year. There'll be a week off before this. Now, that'll be for the 60 players who make the Olympics. But so those guys you would probably take out. But that's, again, no more than four Americans can qualify and all that. So I think they'll get a little more next week because they have that week off. The WGC will actually be moved up a month earlier. And then, so you could almost look at it as the start of a 4 week run here, the way it used to be when there were four playoff events.
That's what I was going to ask you. So this year, the first year of the compressed schedule, it really wasn't about this year. Where we will see the impact of this schedule and what it's intended for is a year like next year, where we have an Olympics and we have a Ryder Cup in addition to the FedEx playoffs and the four majors.
I mean, next year is just, I mean, overstuffed. It's got everything. And, you know, you're going to have going from the Open Championship in England to 2 weeks later, the guys who qualify for the Olympics being over in Japan. You know, you got just bang, bang, bang. Where we had the gap between the two Opens this year, and some players like Webb Simpson took 4 weeks off between Opens. Next year, you're going to have U.S. Open a week off. You're going to have the WGC in Memphis a week off, then the Open Championship. So it's still, guys are still sort of figuring out what works for them. You know, they have to play. They have places they want to play. They have places they maybe tend not to play. But, you know, Webb said he added some he wouldn't normally play and took some away that he likes to play just because of the way the schedule falls and, you know, one event after the other. It's it remains a fluid equation for most of these guys, I think. But, you know, they look at the big events. I mean, from the players on through the four major championships, that's what drives the top players.
The Olympics in Rio, marred by controversy, Zika virus, lame excuses to why one would or wouldn't want to play. Tokyo, you got none of that. Tokyo's like playing in New York City. I would imagine that you're not that players are going to want to be a part of the Olympics. Are they already talking about it?
I think they talk about it when they're asked. I think it's still so far off that I don't, while it might be on their list of goals, I don't think it's first and foremost right now. It's obviously the FedEx Cup, trying to get to Atlanta. That's like everybody's list of goals at the start of the year is to be one of the 30 players at East Lake. And beyond that, there's a President's Cup. I mean, the cutoff for the 8 automatic qualifiers comes after the BMW Championship. And then you've got some time until Tiger has to make his 4 captain's picks. But that's a big deal. I mean, Jordan Spieth and Webb both said here this week that's a massive goal of theirs to be on those things. You know, Webb's been on, I think, 5 teams. Jordan's been part of one. You just sort of automatically expect it. But I mean, Jordan Spieth and Patrick Reed have some work to do to convince Tiger that they belong on that team. I think they'll ultimately be there, but whereas in this time previous years has already checked off the list, it's still an incomplete at this point.
After the controversy with Patrick Reed at last year's Ryder Cup, do you honestly think that someone will take him as a captain's pick?
I think if he's showing form, I think Tiger likes him. I think they, they have a little bit of a bond. I think he would like to have a reason to justify picking him. I mean, you're going to have guys like Tony Finau. I mean, Charles Howell's had a really, really good year. He's never been on any of those teams. You know, I mean, Webb and Ricky Fowler, I think, is outside the top 8 right now. So he's going to have no shortage of guys to pick from. But maybe with Tiger it won't matter. But certainly, I mean, that's the residue of that might linger, and sure, it could affect it. I think, you know, knowing Tiger and watching him through the years, he wants the guys who give him the best chance to win it.
Speaking of Tiger Woods, I'm not sure where he is on that list right now, if he is inside the top 8 or if he is outside the top 8. Do you think Tiger is one who will pick himself over someone else as a captain's pick?
It seemed like a foregone conclusion. He was going to be part of it when he won in Augusta and all that. But I think there's some question right now. I think the next 2 to 3 weeks will tell us a lot. How he plays in Japan, well, I guess by then he'll have to have his things probably cemented. I can't remember the exact date for the final picks. I think he would like to play. But I think if he realizes it's maybe not, I don't know, I want to say more harm than good, but that there are other better options, I think he would do that. He would step aside. I think it's still up in the air. I think it's at best 50-50 if he plays, to me. But I think, again, if he plays well in the next 2 or 3 weeks, then he's right in there and ready to roll.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. You made reference to Tiger in Japan. That's a skins match that's been announced with Tiger and Rory, and I forget who else is participating. My question is,
I think Hideki. And he's also playing the Zozo Champion, the new tournament over there, too.
Is that utilizing either one of those events, utilizing the golf course that will be used for the Olympics?
I don't think so, no.
What is the good storyline to follow this week in Greensboro as far as guys trying to keep their card and get inside that top 125? You always have 3 to 5 guys that you've sort of targeted this week to watch.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, some guys who are outside the top 125 are still secure because of other things like Zach Johnson's outside the top 125, but by virtue of his Open Championship win, he's already secure for next year. Things like, I mean, Bill Haas is a guy immediately who's, I want to say, 140th. And he's in a position where he's going to have conditional status one way or the other after next year, but he wants to get that top 125. He's been outside before when he's come here and played his way in. You know, obviously the local connection and everything. He's a guy who will have a lot of people pulling for him here. There's different guys. I mean, guys like Seamus Power, who lives in Charlotte.
Love Seamus.
Just outside the number, got off to a good start to give him some chance to get there. You know, there's a lot of that. It comes down, you know, on Sunday afternoon, those numbers. Sometime, you know, some years nobody moved in, nobody moved out. They've had as many as 5 guys go from in to out here. So I think it just how that Sunday afternoon comes together. But I think Billy Haas is a guy. But, you know, then there are other guys who want to try to get themselves not just, you know, like Harold Varner from, he's like 93rd or something, would love to get himself up there where he's like 70th or higher. So can really realistically think about playing two of the FedEx Cup playoff events rather than just one. So I think there's all sorts of games within the game there.
Speaking of Bill Haas, you know, there's people who don't think golf is a mental game. I don't think he's ever really recovered from the car crash in L.A. a couple of years ago. If memory serves, although he was not driving, the driver perished. But I don't think Bill was really seriously physically hurt. But it just doesn't seem he's been able to put it all together since that incident.
Yeah, he was. I mean, he got banged up, but nothing serious. You know, I mean, it was a horrible story. I mean, the accident happened. He looked over and knew instantly that his friend had been killed in this accident. And yeah, it coincides with him struggling. Now, he had a hard time getting through the end. Had to work for his status, I think, the year before. But you know, it's amazing. This makes me feel really old. I was talking to a friend of mine, both of whom we have covered Jay Haas through his career, and now we've covered Bill through his. And Bill's, I think, 38, and you know, getting to the point where, you know, he's in the older group out here. It's like, man, how did that happen? We've gone from dad to son, and you know, we must be really getting old. But you know, I talking to him, he said, you know, playing well, I just can't quite get it to go in the hole. He has a lot of really good 3-round tournaments. He needs that 4th round, and you just, you know, it's almost like when you watch Rory play in Koepka last weekend at Memphis, and you get to that Sunday, and it didn't take long to see the body language like, oh no, here it goes again. Not going to get it done on Sunday when you want to. Yeah, maybe it's as simple as getting out of his own way, but I mean, that's a big thing for so many players. I mean, Jordan Spieth sits here this week and just talks about, I know I've got to be patient. And I asked him, I said, are you a patient person? And I mean, before I could finish my question, no.
No, I stand in front of the microwave and yell quicker.
Yeah.
You know, you bring that up about Bill Haas and the whole age thing. That's the way that my wife and I feel whenever Matt Kuchar comes on the screen. And my son is the first to say, oh, my God, that's the oldest man in the world. And we like, wait a minute, wasn't he just the U.S. amateur champ playing with Tiger in 98 at the Masters with his dad on the bag? That was just last week, wasn't it?
It happened. I always say, people say, how long ago was that? I always say it was longer ago than I want to remember, because it just seems like it was how long ago?
From the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, that's Ron Green Jr. I'd also like to thank PGA Tour caddy David Woosley and Kyle Porter, CBSSports.com's Eye on Golf, for their time and insight this week. Reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show and wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, BPod Studios, Spotify, all the usual podcast outlets, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Featured there right now, links to articles on how the Women's Open Championship trophy was stolen. A good tip from Brooks Koepka, and the latest piece of bad luck for Lexi Thompson between two LPGA majors over in Europe. Weather-wise, well, you may be dodging some storms. After all, it's August here in the Carolinas, but still good to tee it up and let this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart. And I tell you what, if you do put a peg in the ground, remember, exhale, swing, pose, and keep in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking 5 of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on 5 we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top 5? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.